Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. 2019 marks the 50th year of the Nobel Memorial Prize in Economic Sciences, better known simply as the Nobel Prize in Economics. Well, until October 14th of this year, just one woman had ever been awarded that prestigious prize. My next guest just became the second. MIT professor Esther Duflo, alongside her research partner Abhijit Banerjee and their frequent collaborator Michael Kramer, were awarded the 2019 prize last month. In its announcement, the Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences wrote, quote, "The research conducted by this year's laureates has considerably improved our ability to fight global poverty. In just two decades, their new experiment-based approach has transformed development economics, which is now a flourishing field of research." Duflo, along with Banerjee, is also the author of a new book. It's called Good Economics for Hard Times, and in it she looks at what the current best economic research says we should do to confront issues that the American public is talking about now, like inequality, immigration, climate change, and more. And she joins me in the studio now. Dr. Duflo, welcome back to WNYC, and congratulations.
Thank you very much.
How does it feel to win a Nobel Prize?
I don't think I have quite processed this fully. There is this period of denial that I haven't completely processed.
Is it something where you know that you're nominated or under consideration and you're kind of waiting for that day in the fall where you're either going to get a phone call or not?
I very much wish I would not have been that kind of person waiting for the phone call, but in any case, it was completely out of the question at my age anyways. So no, I was not waiting for any phone call.
So it was out of the blue.
Completely
as far as
out of the blue.
What time of day did you hear and how did you hear?
Through a phone call a little bit before 5 a.m.
Really?
Which was somewhat unsettling and surprising.
Because you live in the Boston area and it was the middle of the day over in Sweden, so what the heck?
Exactly. They're preparing for a press conference where they announce it at noon. And so they're trying to reach the winners around 11, their time.
Their time, which is like 5 in the morning here. Wow. So with that tiny window, I guess they're really concerned about leaks. They didn't even want to tell you before you went to bed.
No.
And we will get to the book in just a minute. But I do want to ask about your work that the Nobel Committee recognized. You and your colleagues pioneered what's called the experiment-based approach to combating poverty. What is that, and can you give us an example?
So the idea is that you take a big question like how to solve poverty in the world, and you try to break it down into manageable chunks that admit, you know, precise answer. For example, you realize that being poor is about not having education and not being healthy, so you'll say, okay, let me start with education. And so you wonder about, say, how to get kids into school, or how to make sure that they're learning when they're in school. And if you take that question, you're saying, well, for example, suppose that we had more textbooks, would that improve their learning levels? So that becomes a very manageable question, which you can answer. And what we have pioneered and worked with is the idea of answering these precise questions with the same methods that people use to test new drugs. So that's the idea of randomized controlled trials.
So in different countries around the world, okay, let's flood the zone of high poverty areas with new textbooks, or let's do X or let's do Y and see if it has an impact in a few years, things like that?
Exactly. So for example, for textbooks, you could say, well, let's take 100 schools which don't have textbooks, which is the majority of schools in Kenya, say, randomly select half of them, provide textbooks. You don't have to wait many years because you should start seeing the impact within the year. Because you delivered the textbooks randomly, you know that there is nothing systematically different about the schools that got them, so that after a year you can actually know the difference.
Is that a real example?
Yes, that is a real example and not chosen completely randomly, because that's actually the first randomized control trial that Michael Kremer did, which really launched that. And the results were very counterintuitive, because he chose that example expecting to find strong results, and he found nothing. He found absolutely no effect. And it took him several years to persuade himself that there was no mistake. And in fact, there was no mistake, and there was no effect of textbooks.
Because he thought textbooks would have an effect.
Exactly. As many people, I suppose, that would have been the intuition. That's why he picked this example, because he thought it would be a powerful demonstration that you can show that programs work. And in fact, in a sense, what he found was even more interesting, which is our intuitions can be so wrong.
Do you have an example the other way, maybe where your findings went against what you thought going in, but it turned out that something really did help alleviate poverty?
Yes. So, for example, we worked on immunization for kids in India, where we worked in a zone in Rajasthan, in the north of India, where immunization rates were only 5%. So only 5% of kids were getting the five essential immunizations that every kid needs to have. And that's, of course, a huge waste, because, you know, this is the most effective and cost-effective way to save lives. So what we did there, most governments have believed that the reason why immunization rates are low is the services are too far for people. And so they've really worked in trying to improve the immunization services. But it has not been sufficient, in the sense that despite that, many people don't go and get their kids immunized. So what we did there is we worked with an NGO. The first, you know, they pick, again, 120 villages. In 60 of them, they had perfect immunization services. Rain or shine, at people's doorstep, someone was there to immunize the kids every month. And then in half of those villages, they added a very small incentive in the form of a kilo of lentils every time you get a shot. So this, of course, is not going to persuade anybody who thinks that vaccination is bad to do it, because it's something very small, even for people in this area. But for people who generally would like to do it, but don't get around, don't have the time, or have competing priorities, this might be a way of kind of nudging them.
The lentils put them over the top.
Exactly. So it sort of puts it on top of mind. So it's not going to persuade people, but it's going to move them towards doing what they wanted to do anyway. And there what we found is that just improving the services increased immunization rates from 5% to 12%. That's already something. But if you add in addition the kilo of lentil, you get to almost 40% full immunization in the first few years. And in fact, over the years that this organization has continued with them, they are now closer to 90% full immunization. So this worked is something that we had hoped. That this worked so well, it's something that surprised us again.
And did it work so well, not just to save lives, which I would imagine obviously it did, if the vaccination rates for deadly diseases went up so much, but also to improve the futures for some of the people who are getting immunized in economic terms? Because the context here, I think, is about battling poverty. So, of course, first you want to save people's lives, but beyond that, was there an economic impact as these kids grew up, for example, or as these families moved through time?
So I do not know for a fact, because we didn't trace that, but I would expect so, for the simple reason that even though people forget to get immunization, once their kid is sick, they are really willing to go through great lengths in getting treatment for the child. And measles is one of the diseases that these kids get quite frequently. Even if it doesn't kill you, make you very, very sick, and it kind of increases the body sensitivity to other illnesses, such that kids get sick for repeated years after they got measles the first time. So for a family, it could be, it could imply going back to the doctor, to different doctors, and spending a lot of money over the years. But to tell you the truth, even if it didn't, then in a way I still think that I would have done my job, in the sense that one belief we strongly have is that poverty is not just about lack of income, that poverty is very much multidimensional, that not being able to lead a healthy life is a form of poverty, that not being able to have a good education is a form of poverty, that not being able to live in dignity is a form of poverty. So even if it just made the kids healthier, then in a sense, it would have reduced poverty.
My guest is Esther Duflo, who was just named a Nobel laureate last month, Nobel Prize in Economics. And she's the author now of a new book as well, co-author of Good Economics for Hard Times. And we can take your phone calls if you've always wanted to ask a Nobel Prize winning economist a question and never had one over to dinner. Now is your chance. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. I mentioned that you're only the second woman to win the Nobel Prize in Economics. You said you were surprised to win because of your age. I assume that means because you're young. The other female prize winner was Eleanor Ostrom, who was 76 when she won the Nobel Prize. Is it changing to any degree that the field is such a boys' club?
So the field of economics is really dominated by men even today, but a little bit less than when Eleanor Ostrom was coming of age. In fact, she wasn't even an economist. She was a political scientist by training. So she wasn't even trained in that boys' club, although she did great economics. So even to these days, there are not enough women in economics. And I think one of the reasons is that young people considering going to the field don't realize that economics is not just about interest rate and growth rates and central banks and some such, that it is also about social issues here in this country, worldwide issue like climate change, and international global issues like poverty. So I do hope that this prize, not just because it goes to a woman, but it goes to people who work on these issues,
yes,
will make women and minority aware that this is a path they can go into.
Do you think then that some of what we might think is a stereotype is true in some kind of general sense, that men involved in economics might be thinking about global macroeconomics and what happens at the banks and things like that that you just referred to in some way, and women going into the field might have their eyes focused more on the ground, on the fortunes of families and communities and things like that?
It is true on average, but it is not true of every woman and every man, obviously. But it certainly is true on average that within economics, the field of development, labor economics, public finance, health economics, education, has more women. In fact, in development, we're pretty proud that we are a very gender-balanced field.
So we're going to take a very short break, then we'll continue. We'll turn now explicitly to the book. And boy, do people want to speak to you. Our lines are already full. So listeners, your chance, if you've gotten in, or maybe when people finish up with Nobel Prize for Economics, new winner, Esther Duflo, 212-433-WNYC. More after this.
World War I officially ended 100 years ago. The losses and the shock of it changed art, culture, and society's image of itself.
You really have a feeling that here is a building that looks fantastically beautiful, and it's got its whole facade simply blown off by this war.
I'm Sarah Fischko. Join me for a special program, Shell Shock 1919, How the Great War Changed Culture. Today at 2 on 93.9 FM WNYC.
Support for WNYC comes from the 9/11 Memorial and Museum, presenting Revealed, The Hunt for Bin Laden, the extraordinary story of the 10-year hunt for the perpetrator of the September 11th terror attacks, opening November 15th, 2019. Geico Insurance, celebrating over 75 years of providing auto insurance for drivers across America. Geico can also help insure motorcycles, RVs, homes, and more. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC with MIT professor and newly named Nobel laureate in economics, Esther Duflo. She's the author as well of a brand new book called Good Economics for Hard Times. And after spending your career studying poverty in developing countries, you turned to some big topics in the United States and Western Europe for your book, like immigration, global trade, and climate change. Why?
When we finished Poor Economics, we thought we were done with writing books. And then when 2016 rolled around and we heard the conversation around the presidential election in this country, around Brexit in the UK, we got a little bit appalled by the way it was going. We felt that the political rhetoric, in particular the populist, nationalist populist rhetoric, left absolutely no space for an intelligent conversation on these key issues. That the public tended to absolutely not trust economists, partly because economists had painted themselves into a corner with the best economists remaining quiet in their offices and the most strident sort of taking the stage. So we decided that it was almost a moral obligation to do something about it.
So on migration, for example, obviously such a central issue in the Trump era, one argument in your book that might take listeners by surprise is that the real migration crisis in economic terms is not that too many people are moving around, it's that too many people are staying put. Want to make that case?
Yes, so I think we are victim to the sort of this this failure of reasoning, which is like, oh, our lives here are so much better than the lives overseas, that if we didn't have very strong immigration borders, everybody would want to come. And we forget that the migration flows are actually remarkably low, especially given these differences in standard of living. And the reason why it's a crisis is not so much because international migration is too low, it's because within country migration is too low. So for example, in the US, I think people tend to think that Americans are extremely mobile, but as it turns out, they are not. They're completely stuck in place. The mobility from one country to the next has halved since 1948. It's about 3% today, every year. And the consequence of that is that when a shock hits, for example, your factory closes because of competition with China or because of artificial intelligence or robots replacing your job.
You should move to find the next line of work.
Oh, yeah, well, you don't. And if you do not, economists always assume that people are going to move. And in fact, when you ask people, should people move if they lost their job? They say, yeah, yes, of course they move. But then if you ask them about themselves, it's like, no, I wouldn't move.
Yeah. It's because economics are not the only incentives in people's lives, right? They want to stay where their families are, things like that.
Yes. So first of all, often it is actually hard for people to move because the real estate is very expensive where they should be going, and often they are underwater on their mortgage, so they don't even have money. At least where they have a house. So those are economic reasons. But on top of that, people are motivated by much more than money. So first of all, we are social beings, and social connections matter. And of course, where have you always been? You have your family, you have your social network, and this is extremely valuable to people, to all of us as human beings. And the second is that when people are interviewed, what is clear is that they want to derive a meaning from their work. And suppose you've been making furniture in a factory for 30 years, then you become the foreman or some manager in the factory. You're good at what you're doing, and you derive meaning from your work. If that job disappears, the economists in us would say, well, whatever, you can now become a watchman in a furniture-selling stores in New York.
Mm-hmm.
Where is that sense of meaning and purpose going to come from your job? And that is something that we have had as an economic profession a complete blind spot about.
Maria in Mount Kisco, you're on WNYC with Esther Duflo. Hi, Maria.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. And first, congratulations, Esther. I was thrilled when I learned that you got the Nobel Prize. And my question to you is, what attracts you to this field that used to be, maybe not so much anymore, but 20 years ago was a niche in economics? What attracted you to developing countries and the way you have approached research, which is very refreshing, by the way? I also took an online course with you 3 years ago.
Well, thank you very much, and I'm very glad you took the course. So, to be honest, I only got interested in economics when I understood that it could be a tool to play a meaningful role, perhaps in helping the poorest people in the world. I always thought of myself as having some kind of a mission or a duty to help the poorest people in the world since when I was a kid. But I thought this would be a sort of side business. And at some point, I was lucky enough to meet some economists in action and to realize that they actually have the possibility to make a real difference through their work. And so I decided to study economics in graduate school. And at that point, I was pretty determined that this was going to be development.
Maria, thank you for your call. Michael in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC with Esther Duflo. Hi, Michael.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
You have a question, I see.
So I was wondering if you could talk about how you see the kind of political causes of poverty, because one thing that I'm curious about is, like, is poverty something like an illness that we can cure through experimentation, or is it something that people do to each other? And what we should be thinking about maybe is forces like globalization and imperialism and kind of more historical forces that create poverty.
Could you ask a bigger question the next time you call it? No, I'm kidding. Dr.
So
Duflo?
So certainly the story of the history plays, as a long shadow and continue to determine social relation and the system in which people live. But once you've said that, the question is, how do you move forward from there? And you could say, well, that's kind of unfortunate, or you could wait for the revolution, or you could say, what it is that I can do here and now? And that include, by the way, in trying to make the institutions better, because in a lot of these countries that have a history of exploitation are today democracy. We take India, for example. It's a very vibrant democracy. But yet there is ways in which this democracy as a democracy could function better. For example, if people voted less with their caste and more with their economic interest, something, by the way, that we could also learn from in these countries, to vote less with your group and more with your economic interest. And there, as soon as you ask the question this way, then it becomes one of these practical questions you can answer. So I think it's very useful for some people to study history, and then they can talk to us about institution in, like, big letters. And my temperament is more to think about institution in small letters, which is all of the details that actually make a society tick. And you'd be surprised how large things that can appear to be details to start with, how large a difference they can make in the functioning of institutions on a day-to-day basis.
Fascinating. Jack in North Brunswick, you're on WNYC with Esther Duflo. Hi, Jack.
Hi. My question regards the wealth tax proposal from Warren and from Sanders, which is roughly 2% on $50 million and 3% on billionaires. Does France has a history of this? Does it work? Is it reasonable?
So I do think it's perfectly reasonable. I think one way to think about it is this way. So don't think about it as a kind of a revolutionary move to strip the billionaire away from their wealth. Think about it in a much more pragmatic way, which is a lot of the income from wealth isn't taxed because it's never realized in the form of going back to people in income. It kind of keeps being reinvested. And therefore, there is a perfectly legal way in which people who are making a lot of money from their wealth because they invest it and say they get a return of about 6% a year because it's a lot of money, so it gets a higher return than the average return on the market, pay almost nothing on it because they realize so little of these gains. So think of a 3% wealth tax as a 50% income tax on the income that is otherwise never being realized. Mm. So once you think about it this way, it's, I think, eminently reasonable. It's just a way of bringing all of the income on the same tax net.
I've heard a critique of the wealth tax, which for people who haven't thought of this yet, and obviously this is an Elizabeth Warren plan that has it in the news, but a wealth tax is on the amount of wealth that you have rather than on the amount of income that you get in that particular year. And one of the critiques I've heard is that countries that have wealth taxes have a very hard time actually collecting it because people can hide cash assets that you might be able to see in a bank account or brokerage account or something by buying art, by buying jewelry, by buying other kinds of possessions. And so it's impossible to enforce fairly and effectively. What would you say about that?
So that's a practical question, isn't it? So I actually think that it's much easier to tax the entire stock of wealth than to tax the unrealized gains on
income.
So that's why
investments.
That's why I do think that it's a more that it's a more practical way to tax the income from wealth to tax the entire wealth, because it's very difficult to measure the income for wealth. But in France, as the auditor mentioned, we have had a wealth tax for years until the government just got rid of it recently. And as a practical matter, it was working very well. So I think if there is a willingness to do it, it's really a set of practical questions to put it in place. And in fact, it would be quite good, because once you have put it in place, even at a small level, you now have the apparatus to measure wealth properly and to tax it at the level that society seems fit at a moment or another.
They eliminated the wealth tax in France?
Yep.
How come?
I think it was an electoral promise by the young president to his to a lot of the people who funded his campaign.
Huh. So Macron ended the wealth tax.
Yep.
And your theory as to why sounds very American. Karen in Roselle Park gets our last question for Nobel Prize in Economics winner Esther Duflo. Hi, Karen.
Hi, good morning. I'm a teacher, and I actually teach a small segment on economics to middle schoolers. And besides just your usual savings and accruing interest, I just wondered if there was, you know, something else important to take away in economics. Maybe you have, I don't know, a curriculum you could recommend, or because I teach kids at many different levels, from very poor to very wealthy, and if there would be like one lesson that they could take. I know that's kind of a lot to ask, but what would you recommend? Because I feel it's so important to teach kids at such a young age. And when I say economics, like, they almost start to fall asleep immediately. So I don't know what your thoughts are about that.
That's a fantastic question. I think that's a critical question to get right, because it's very important to create a bridge between, you know, students, middle school students who are the citizens of tomorrow and economists, and also hopefully to encourage some vocations. So in fact, with my colleagues, we are going to invite high school students from around the area in Boston and expose them to other facets of economists besides, you know, your savings accrue interest. I think what you should teach them is what you take an issue that you think they're passionate about. So it could be global poverty, or it could be discrimination, or it could be inequality, or it could be mobility, or it could be climate change. And then show them just one or two examples of one specific project in people having made progress in these areas. And I would, you know, for each of these topics, you would find like one study. It's like awfully self-serving, but in poor economics, for example, our previous book, you would find a kind of illuminating example of how research on people's behavior with free bed nets for malaria has allowed the has led to the distribution of millions of bed nets and contributed to averting 450 million deaths from malaria. In our current book, you could have a discussion about whether migration hurts the natives' wages or not, and there might be, you know, you might walk them to the intuition that yes, it should, because more workers mean lower wages, and then they would be very surprised to find out that actually it doesn't. And then you could kind of explain why and discuss that with the class, and I think that would make them aware that economics is such a richer and more subtle and less ideological discipline than they might think, and maybe they would even wake up. I don't know.
Karen, good luck with those middle schoolers. Thank you for your call. And great thanks to Esther Duflo, MIT professor, co-winner this fall of the Nobel Prize in Economics, and now co-author of Good Economics for Hard Times. Thank you so much for coming into our studio.
Thank you so much.